From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2017 under an oak tree at the University of Michigan. Writer Kristen Rupenian was marveling at a voicemail she had just received from her agent, in which she learned that one of her short stories would be published in The New Yorker. Rupenian says she remembered thinking, "This is it. This is the happiest I will ever be." On December 4th that year, the magazine published Cat Person. The story quickly went viral. It seemed just about everyone was talking about Cat Person, a third-person narrative about the relationship and bad sexual encounter between a college student and a man she briefly dated. The Atlantic Monthly called the story a literary adjunct to the latest Me Too moment. In January of this year, Rupenian wrote a piece for The New Yorker describing what it was like to have her story go viral. She said, quote, "For a few hours after Cat Person went viral, I got to live the dream and the nightmare of knowing exactly what people thought when they read what I had written," end quote. Rupenian's success stands out in what was already a banner year for the short story. According to The Guardian, 2017 was the best year for short stories since 2010. 50% more short story collections were sold in 2017 than in 2016. But The Guardian also reports that a so-called renaissance for the short story is a repetitive myth that we hear, well, every so many years, a myth that detracts from talking about short stories in a way that deepens our understanding of them. So is that a fair criticism? And what do the numbers say? Where do short stories stand when it comes to current literary trends? We'll discuss those questions with some writers and publishers this hour. We're going to discuss some of their work, The Art of Writing a Short Story. And I already got a note from a listener who thought that the intro at the top of the hour was a little condescending when I was asking a very honest question, which is, when's the last time you read a book? That is not meant to be condescending. We are busy. We have busy lives. We consume writing in various ways just about all day long. So when I ask that question, it's not a, I'm better than you, you know. Not at all. It's just more of an honest question. And it's very interesting to hear about our literary consumption habits. So hello to those of us in studio. Peter Connors is here, publisher for BOA Editions. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And Brian Wood is here. His new book is a collection of stories called Joytime Killbox. I cannot, on the air, say what I told Brian about the book before the hour began, but did you take it as an endorsement?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the kind words that you can't share.
The kind words that I cannot share. Mildly vulgar, but definitely impressed. Thank you for being here.
Appreciate it.
Also with us is Kristen Gentry, a writer and associate professor of English and creative writing at SUNY Geneseo. Welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, I'm going to start with you on the publishing side of things. This is kind of like the humanities question, where every few years we go, oh no, the humanities is dying. Short stories is either dying or then maybe the novel is dying and short stories will replace it. Do we cycle through this, or are things actually changing?
You know, I think that there is something with the attention span that you had touched on, that short stories appeal to people who have a limited amount of time. And, you know, I think having things so available online, including short fiction, is really helpful, too, because people can just pull up stories in different ways. You know, at BOA, we have been publishing for 43 years, but only publishing short fiction for the past 12 of them. And part of the reason why we transitioned into publishing short fiction is because, from the publishing standpoint, short story collections have always been seen as the gateway to the novel. So a lot of times the major publishers would be interested in a short story collection insofar as the next book would be a novel, and that was sort of the step up. And as a result, there were a lot of places that just wouldn't publish short story collections. They were seen in the publishing world as not that appealing. And so I felt like at BOA, although we're a nonprofit publishing house, that we should focus on doing short stories as well, short story collections, because they were a little bit endangered as far as the publishing landscape. So 12 years ago, we started publishing short fiction, and now we've done 24 story collections, and we have an annual BOA Short Fiction Prize that's in its 10th year. So we've really embraced the form.
Did you read Cat Person, by the way?
I have not.
Okay, see. All right, so this is what's interesting to me. I want to ask it from the publisher perspective. Is Cat Person came out in December of 2017 in The New Yorker. And the Harvey Weinstein expose from both the New Yorker and the New York Times had come just 2 months before. So Rapinian was clearly writing that piece before the Me Too movement launches. I think people saw that come out and they thought, oh, well, this is smart. Short story writers capitalizing on a moment, where I don't think that was the case. But do you think, as a publisher, is it wise to try to capitalize on where sort of the zeitgeist is? Or do you, is it hard to sort of guess how that's going to land?
Well, my guess is that the author was probably working on that well before that Weinstein story broke. And I mean, we see that all the time with great art. It sort of leads the way into what happens next. And of course, we have journalism to tell us what's going on at any given moment. But a lot of times, short fiction can sort of set up a scenario, well in advance, or that echoes what's going on. But it is because they deal with such universal truths and relationships and so forth, they can speak in a larger way as opposed to an immediate event.
Well, you just published Brian Wood's work. We're going to talk about that specifically in a moment. But generally speaking, short stories, I mean, do you consume more of them? Or do you write more short stories? What's your consumption habit like?
I read anything and everything. One thing I try to do is, there was some advice that was given by Ray Bradbury that said you should read a story, an essay, and a poem every day. So I try to do that while I'm reading novels as well.
Every day?
Yes.
You really do that?
Yes.
What's the poem you read yesterday?
Yesterday was Robert...
I'm mostly kidding.
Robert Lowell Epilogue.
What was it?
Epilogue by Robert Lowell. Is Lowell? Lowell?
Lowell? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. No, that's really cool.
It only takes about 2 minutes to read a poem, Evan. Come on, man.
No, I know. And listen, we love talking poetry on this program, and I'm appreciative of the work. Of course, Peter knows I'm appreciative of the work. I'm not... And by the way, you didn't have to key in on the poem, just like I did. It could have been anything. I'm more impressed with the actual act of committing to reading a poem. What were the three? It was a
poem, an essay, and a story.
Poem, an essay, and a story every day. So where do you draw that from then? What's your source material for that?
Well, there's lots of story collections out there if you want to pay attention. I think it's
just BOA, right? Just turn to BOA?
Yeah, just go to BOA only. BOA.com. No. That's not their website, by the way. Obviously, I'm going to literary websites like Electric Lit or Lit Hub, and they have free stories you can read. And a lot of times these are places where, again, like Peter was saying, these are authors that maybe not have a voice because they're not writing a novel, but it's a great way to see some avant-garde writing. And to me, I think it's just some of the highest quality writing you're going to read is in the short story form.
In 2020, I'm going to read one poem a day. I'm going to do it.
Easy peasy.
I love that idea. Kristen, what's your consumption habit when it comes to writing?
I largely read short story collections, and I mean, I think that's because I enjoy them, and also because of the point that that Peter made about time, and that Brian echoes with, you can read a piece in its entirety in one day, and also because I'm in the thick of writing a collection, so I'm trying to consume and get inspiration for my writing, so short story collections.
You're writing short stories, but not essays, right?
No.
It's short stories.
Correct.
Yeah. So we're going to talk process this hour, because I think it'll be instructive for anybody who likes to write, but also people. I love getting inside the minds of writers and to understand process here. And Peter, as the publisher of BOA Editions, you probably should tell people what the actual website is, because it's not BOA.com. I'm scared to know what actually is on BOA.com. I didn't look it up, because WhiteHouse.com is not the White House. So I don't know what BOA is, but what's BOA Editions online?
We are BOAEditions.org. So it's just BOAEDITIONS.org.
Emery Stein's going to find out what BOA.com is, because I want to make sure we're not getting anybody in trouble. But that would be very much like Brian Wood to get us in trouble in that way.
It's probably just snake enthusiasts. It's not
So, Brian, your new book is Joy Time Kill Box, and the essay Joy Time Kill Box gets the title probably because it's the most stirring essay in the book. Story in the book. But can we talk about that one first here?
Absolutely.
Right out of the gate. Joy Time Kill Box. First of all, if you were teaching a class and said, hey, students, you're going to write an essay called Joy Time Kill Box, I would love to see what the students create. What you created was a story about a Joytime kill box set when? When is the story set?
Tomorrow.
Yeah, it's set now.
Yeah.
Or whenever. It's sort of nondiscriminate. And the Joytime kill box is an actual box in which somebody is going to get killed.
Yes.
One person every 4 years or something, if I remember from the I keep saying essay story.
Yeah, I think it's some algorithm that kind of remotely will make you sit down in a box and you face down a barrel of a gun and just randomly it'll go off at some point. And so
not at some point when you're in it. One person has to be in there for how long?
I think it was like 60 seconds.
You're in there for 60 seconds, and the gun, from the vast, vast majority of people who wait to kind of ride this ride, it's almost like an amusement park ride, the gun does not go off. You get out of the box after sweating and thinking about death, and then you leave. But one time every, 4 years or so, the algorithm will actually fire it, and someone will die.
Correct, yeah.
Try, if you could, take me into your mind as to where this came from.
Okay, so the idea for this actually came, I was at Sunday school about like 15, 20 years ago, and this youth pastor said, what would you do if you were sitting down and you had to look down the barrel of a gun and it might go off or might not go off? What would you think about? And I was like, "What? This is the weirdest illustration I've ever heard." And I'd carried that around with me for some reason for decades.
From Sunday school?
Weird, bad analogy that a youth pastor, I think he was really nervous or I don't know what, but he was doing this terrible analogy and just swimming in it. And I just remembered that, and it's just a splinter that's been in my brain for decades. And that's where the idea came from a youth pastor.
But you chose to create not just the idea of looking down the barrel of a gun, but turning it into something that people voluntarily almost ride like a ride, right? They have to sign a waiver, which kind of removes liability if they're the one who gets killed. Okay, so why did you turn it into this kind of setting?
Well, I was thinking of it kind of in the same way where folks who skydive know that there is a off chance maybe the parachute doesn't work right, but perhaps maybe that's the reason they do it, knowing that there's danger involved, minuscule, but danger involved. Or when bungee jumping was a fad in all those decades ago. You'd always hear the story about the bungee snapping or, you know, something like that. And so I just kind of wanted to push it to the absurd and to the edges of satire.
Okay. And I understand that we're giving away a lot of the story here. But
that's fine.
Trust me when I say it is an intense story. I think it's worth reading because, at least for me, it pushed me to think a little bit about some broader themes, but I'm worried that you're going to tell me you weren't even going for that. This was all in my head, not yours.
You're welcome to take anything you want from it. I'm not going to spoil. You know, it's kind of like when the artist doesn't want to share what the music lyrics actually
mean. Exactly. See? No, come on, man. I want to know if the Joytime kill box, is it a commentary on our constant need to find a greater and greater thrill, even if it is literally stupid and could result in our skull being blown off of our neck. Is it any kind of a commentary on us as a society, thrill-seeking, or was it just sort of a cool device that you had there?
Maybe a little from column A, a little from column B. I thought, you know, just the idea of how absurd it is, what people do to get attention. Like, it could be something like taking pictures of your breakfast. Like, if you told somebody about that 20 years ago, that seems like just a bizarre behavior, but it's so commonplace now. And so I wanted to pick something like very bizarre that folks would line up and do and not even think anything about it. And then through our narrator, you have this kind of voyeuristic experience of experiencing that with him.
He's in line, and he is near, it's a big line, but he's near a young girl who is quite the snarky child. She's making fun of just about everybody because she is way cooler than all the adults around. And there's also an old man who is in line, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And the idea that you're about to get in this box and the gun's going to be turned on you, the closer you get to the box, the more real it gets. And the more you start to hear people screaming or nervous or people are sweating or sometimes people are soiling themselves. All these things could be happening in the box. And then the crew takes the next person out and the next person in. I mean, it's quite an intense, but by the time we get to the point where the narrator is getting into the box, it's quite intense here. And I found myself wondering, are we going to experience the one time the gun goes off, whether it's at the narrator or not, the girl, the old man, somebody else in line, are you going to choose to do it that way? You had a lot of choices here. That's why I say, as a professor, it'd be really interesting then to say, okay, I've written half the story. I'm going to keep doing that, and I apologize for that. I've written half the story. Where are you going to take this? You had a lot of choices to make there. Without giving too much away, take me a little bit inside your process to why you decided to take in the direction you did.
It's not that I really wanted to subvert the reader's expectations, but I wanted to try to keep it as commonplace as possible. And that was in the back of my mind writing it, was I wanted it to be absurd and weird and strange and unsettling. But at the same time, I wanted to temper that with, like, this is just another day, another hour, another minute of this thing that's taking place all the time.
Yeah. For me, again, I'm probably reading too much into it, but I thought there might be some commentary on a society that is just absolutely accepting of gun violence and gun death, saying, okay, yep, this happens. It's even oddly thrilling. People know it's happening. Nobody wants to stop it. Is that the reader reading too much into it?
No, I'm glad you picked up on that. Another source of inspiration for the piece was Kafka in the Penal Colony. It's a short story about this elaborate contraption that kills prisoners. And there's this reporter that shows up on this, you know, faraway exotic island to report about this machine. And the colonel is just so happy and pleased with this death device. And he goes into, like, such great detail describing it and is bragging about it. And it's this horrific story that's kind of, you know, the way Kafka's funny and the way he tells these horrific things. But that was another inspiration for it, was how horrific and just really unsettling when you think about it. But it's so accepted and commonplace, and people brag about doing it or experiencing it. And so, yeah, that was definitely, you didn't read in too much. You were a very good reader. Thank you so much.
We're here just for you to praise me, so thank you. I appreciate that. Can you also kind of give me a sense for how you feel about trying to capture a moment in sort of cultural time in the same way that someone like Kirsten Rupinian did in The New Yorker, even if it was accidental, that Cat Person comes out right after the launch of the Me Too movement, and we're sort of ready for a story like that, and all of a sudden it gains this velocity. Something like Joytime Killbox feels like it could do that, given some of the themes that that readers may find there, whether it's gun violence, need for thrills, you know, those kinds of things. Are you, as a writer, ever thinking about that? Are you thinking, I'm going to write the stories that I want to write, and if they happen to capture a moment, if I get lucky, I get lucky?
For me, I just try to follow the energy. You know, if I try to follow what's happening right now, by the time I get it done, and if I'm lucky enough to get it published, it's going to be like 3 years. I'm going to be 3 years behind.
Yeah.
By the time anything comes to light of day. Like, I think you just have to go with where the energy is and write it passionately and honestly and with no regrets, and just go where you need to go and go for it. And if you go after it with that kind of passion, it's going to find an audience and it's going to resonate.
Peter, how did you feel the first time you read Joytime Killbox, that particular story, not the entire collection?
You know, it's really interesting because there is that intensity around the activity of the gun coming out, which made me think personally a lot about, like, reality TV and our sort of voyeuristic society of wanting to see how these people react in this really high stress situation. But what I was most taken by was the interaction between the people in line, which in and of itself is much more benign. I mean, these are really just, the dynamic is there's this sort of, you know, saucy and sassy young girl who keeps going back in line over and over. There's a very nervous man and going through his first time in it. And there's an older sort of grandfatherly type gentleman who's got a sort of outside view of this thing and much more calm and relaxed and been there and done that. So I was really interested in the dynamics there, and it's it's, you know, that sort of speaks to the power of short story, because as sensationalistic as the idea of these people waiting to sit in front of a gun barrel is, the true power of the story is in the interpersonal relationship between these characters in line. So that's what, to me, makes it timeless.
And as they get closer to the actual Joytime kill box, we find, at least I found as a reader, more humanity and more texture. They start off as these caricatures, kind of, and they become more real people with a little bit more layered emotions. At least that's how I read it. How did you read it, Peter?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I love, too, what Brian did is he bookended it with interactions between, at first, there's a employee at the Joytime Killbox Inc., I guess it is, who's offering insurance policies. You know, do you want to take out an insurance policy on your life based on what you're about to go through? And just, like, so blasé about the whole thing. And then at the very end, there's essentially a gift shop that you go through to get your face sitting in front of the gun on a mug, on a t-shirt, on a calendar, these kind of things. So, it's very realistic in this way, but it's also, as Brian mentioned with the Kafka, it's horrifying. That's why we came up with the word Kafkaesque. It's very Kafkaesque. It's disturbing and also very real.
Kristen, how do you like the dark kind of short stories like this that take us into these intense, dark places in the span of what, I don't know how long that was maybe 15 to 25 pages is all, and you go to these dark places. How do you feel about that?
I loved it. I was immediately pulled in by the employee at Joytime Inc. and, like, wondering what was happening. And
I was the same. I'm like, what are they doing here?
Yeah, why is there a possibility that there might not be much left? It was just, like, it just pulled me in, and, like, my stomach was getting tighter and tighter as I read the story. It was just, like, a wonderful story that speaks to, like, that excitement of a bibliophile, which, like, what's going to happen next, right? But also speaking to those greater themes that you point out about, like, gun violence and voyeurism and, like, the connection. And yeah, take me to the dark place, because I liked it. Yeah.
Well, for me, you go back to, and it, this isn't something I knew off the top of my head. I was glad to get help from producer Megan Mack, who was the first person who actually showed me this story. June 26, 1948, The New Yorker published a story called The Lottery. And I read Brian's piece, Brian's story, Joytime Killbox, and I thought of The Lottery. And The Lottery is a story that, if you haven't read it, you should. Now consider the fact that in 1948, it sparks a backlash among readers who are going, you can't do this. This is way too dark. This is awful. This is horrifying. The Lottery is different than Joytime Killbox, but there is a similar idea that for those participating, either voluntarily or a compulsory participation, someone must die. It's going to be dark. You don't really know why, especially when it starts. There's some context missing. Is that comparison okay with you?
I'm totally fine with any comparison. I remember the first time I read The Lottery. This is how far we've come, I guess. If in 1948 they're saying it's dark and you can't do this, I remember reading it in the seventh grade. And we're reading short stories.
You were in the seventh grade in 1948.
Yeah, I know. It's sunscreen. But, you know, you read, like, the O. Henry stories or Lady and the Tiger, and there's a little twist at the end. We read one called The Lottery. I'm like, man, this story is lame. It's just like people standing around picking up rocks. Like, what the heck is this podunk story?
And then that's how you felt about The Lottery?
And then you get to the end of it, and you're just when
you're reading it.
Yes, yes, yes. And it stuck with me ever since.
Because the ending is jarring.
Yeah, I think we can spoil the ending. If you haven't seen The Sixth Sense, he's dead the whole time. And if you haven't read The Lottery, they all whoever wins the lottery gets killed. There you go. So you should check it out either
way.
That
is not a lottery you want to win, turns out. Yes. If you are the winner of the lottery, the stones are coming for you.
Yeah, and I was just I had no idea that she attended the University of Rochester. And I was just absolutely tickled. Moving here from the Bay Area of California, she grew up in San Francisco area, moved out here. So it was really cool knowing that there's that connection there as well.
Well, and that's why I think in the back of my mind when I'm reading Joytime Killbox, when you read The Lottery, you don't exactly know what's happening, but you know something dark is going down. And you feel like you are moving toward that conclusion one way or another. I wondered if that's what I was going to experience with Joytime Killbox. And that's why I think I just appreciate the entire story, because I think like Kristen felt, you're trying to piece it together from the clues early on. What exactly is happening? Who is involved and why and where are we going? It was creative, clever, horrifying in its way, but entirely original. So I don't know. Congratulations for Joytime Killbox, which is just one of the stories in the collection of stories that bears that name, Joytime Killbox. It's out now? Is it out now? The book's available now. Where can people get it, Peter?
Yeah, it's out. It was published in October, so it's just out, and it's available. You can actually pick up copies at boaeditions.org, or you can get them anywhere that you buy books, especially if you're a local independent bookseller, or online, or wherever you like to buy books. It is out there in the world. It's a fantastic book.
Before the hour's over, I'm going to ask our guests to share what their favorite short story they have come across is, because I think of stories like The Lottery that go viral, Cat Person goes viral, but there's so much out there that we don't always experience. That's why BOA is here, and frankly, that's why it's nice to be able to sometimes give a microphone to that, because there's great work happening, whether it's Brian, Kristen, and the many that Peter and his team put the spotlight on. So after our only break of the hour, I want Kristen and Brian to take us through process, because some writers, when they write, especially when they're writing novels, the process is different than it would be for a short story writer, or maybe I'm wrong. So they're going to give me a sense for how they view the process of writing. Kristen has indicated sometimes it's longer than she'd like it to be, because we're trying to get the material out here. So let's talk about process for writers when we come back with Brian Wood, the author of Joytime Killbox. Peter Connors is publisher for BOA Editions. Kristen Gentry is an associate professor of English and creative writing at SUNY Geneseo. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. A local organization is bringing some students and some ideas to mind as we talk about the future of education and opportunity for everyone. Then in our second hour, new polling indicates there is a generational divide between what Americans want. Older Americans want continuity. Younger Americans want radical change. We'll hash it out. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's talk a little bit about process, because we know that short stories are, at the very least, and again, I'm not trying to be sort of glib or not recognize that things go in cycles, but they're having a moment. Forbes reported just last week, science fiction short stories are having a banner year. The Guardian writes that that we have seen kind of an ebb and flow, but the short story kind of coming of age. And so given the frequency of its birth and rebirth, we think it's a nice moment, especially with Brian's book out, to talk about the process and what's going on with the industry right now. So on the process side, Kristen Gentry, when you sit down, is the idea I'm going to crank out the story in its most complete form possible and then edit it? Will you write a page at a time? I mean, what's the process for you in short stories?
It takes me a long time to write a short story, almost embarrassingly long, because I don't set out with, like, I'm going to write a page today or I'm going to write 500 words, although that would probably be to my benefit to do that. I begin at the beginning and then I return to the beginning over and over again, because I feel like so much of the satisfaction of reading a story is that the end returns to the beginning in a way that is almost inevitable, but you didn't realize it at the beginning of the story. And so that's what takes me so long, because I'm trying to get the beginning sharp, because that paves the way for everything else.
Well, in an interview Brian did with BOA, I think Brian was saying short stories can be harder because you don't feel like there's room for error. It's got to be airtight. Do you feel that way?
Yes, I do. Everything has to serve a purpose. Every word has to be doing something, sometimes two or three things at the same time.
Are there moments where you're kind of super productive and you go, oh my gosh, I got it? you know, even in one or two sessions?
Sometimes, and those days are glorious and wonderful, and angels sing, and Jesus comes down and whatnot. But those days are few and far between. Usually, I'm just happy that I've sat down and I've written something, and I feel like I'm a little bit closer to the goal.
Okay. Brian, your process. Take me through it.
Well, I like to have a cup of coffee, and then, no, I mean, it depends.
You tweet the picture of the cup of coffee?
Yeah, exactly. I tweet out the picture of the cup of coffee. But, like, in this collection, the Joy Time Killbox story, I wrote that one the fastest out of any of the pieces.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, it just came out, like, just torrential. And that's usually not my process. I'm usually, I feel like I'm doing, like, masonry work sometimes, where you're just shaping each stone and placing it where it needs to be so it all fits in nice and tight, whereas this one was just free flowing. As I wrote it as fast as I could and got the first draft done just in a few days.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about that theme of the pressure for a short story, because it's got to be tight. You know, this is not a 300 page story. This is could be a 3-page story, could be a 30-page story, but it's got to be tight.
Sure. Just for me personally, in what I've read and thinking about language, I put poets at the top. They use the least amount of words to get their point across. It has to be perfect. It has to have weight. It has to be spring-loaded and tight. And after that, I would say it's the short story writer who's using a few more words than the poet's going to use. So I think of it in the way that the poet kind of stays up all night trying to get the perfect word, or like shouting it to the trees on a walk, trying to make sure it sounds right. There's a lot of pressure in a short story that just there's no room for error. Everything has to work. Everything has to be pulling its weight, or it's no good. It's not good enough for short fiction.
Peter, how is the state of the industry now? I see that novelist Zadie Smith, who I love, recently published her first short story collection. How would you say the state of the industry is?
I think people are maybe more open to short story collections. You know, you have people who come along and sort of revitalize the form. I think recently a good example is George Saunders, who he also is a Syracuse University professor, and his first book was called Civil War Land in Bad Decline. And it's an outstanding book of short stories, some of which were written while he was living here in Rochester. But, you know, an author like that comes along and then people sort of appreciate short stories. You know, he's going on the Colbert Report and all these different things. So he's really becomes the public face of short stories for a while. And that happens cyclically. But I think right now people are open to short stories. And I think there's more places where they're appearing too, more venues for short stories and for people to encounter them.
Yeah. One of our volunteers, David Griffin, says one of his favorite short stories is 10th of December. By George Saunders. So, yeah, they can be mainstream, though Brian has said this is like going to see garage bands that you're never going to hear on the radio. That's harsh. It's a little harsh, Peter, isn't it?
Well, I publish poetry collections, so this is not news to me. You know, I'm like, short stories, these are super mainstream. That's awesome. But, you know, Brian brings up a really good point. And again, this is one of the reasons why BOA got into publishing short fiction when we had really just been committed to publishing poetry. Short story writers have to be very conscious of each word they use, and they really are economical, and the collections that I like the most, the collections that we publish at BOA, are crafted just as well as any poem you can find, but they have these really great, compelling narratives to them as well.
Outside of process, there's the idea of idea generation. So for you, Kristen, are you driving home, something hits you, an incident happens, a theme, something else you read? Are you jotting notes down for yourself or texting yourself ideas? Or do you set aside time where you sit down and you think, I want to create a stream of ideas here for stories? How does it happen?
Usually the ideas just come to me. Like, actually, this morning I was writing down a short story idea that came to me last night in a dream. Now, it doesn't always happen that way, but it came to me in a dream last night. And there was just this odd woman, and she lived in a hotel. And that's all I knew. And she was encountering a couple who had just gotten married. And so this morning when I woke up, I got my journal and I just started writing. So they can come like that, or a lot of times they can come from like bits and pieces of conversations that I've had with people. I'll just take an idea from the conversation that stuck with me, and I'll base a story around that idea.
Okay. Brian, what about you?
I try not to journal too much myself, because most of my ideas are terrible and really bad. And if I journal my bad ideas, it's like this, it keeps them alive. And usually I'll just forget the bad ideas and I'll remember the good ones. So I try.
Really?
Yeah. Well, like I said, like this, you know, a youth pastor 20-something years ago telling that dumb story. It's like
you're a big fan of that youth pastor.
Yeah, man. He hooked me up with the title for my book. So okay.
Who knew 22 years later? You might have been traumatized with that image.
Sure.
But hey.
Well, sometimes like I would try to overhear an interesting piece of dialogue and then try to build a story around that. But a lot of that came out unfruitful when I would do something like that. So again, like if it's memorable and it's something you're not going to forget, it might be something worth following.
Can you help me understand where an idea comes from about an old man who wants to start a fire?
Yes.
There's a story in your book called Fallen Timbers.
Okay.
And it is a strange story of a man who wants to burn down an old fort.
Haven't you ever wanted to do that when you go to those forts?
Well, I mean, no, frankly. But why don't you set the scene a little bit about what that story is, and then I'd love to hear where it came from.
Okay, sure. So the story is about an interaction between someone driving a car, and he picks up an old man that's walking on the side of the road, and he looks like he's laboring, and it's very hot. So he picks him up, and they begin talking, and he's like, what are you doing? Where are you going? And the old man says, I'm taking this gas. I'm going to go burn the fort down. They have one of those historical forts in their town. So, and then the story is how that resolves. Yeah.
Where did that, what happened?
Okay. So I was living briefly in Toledo, Ohio. It was my first experience with the Midwest, so it's fun to get to go to a new place. And so I think being a stranger there, I was very observant of new places, new things. And I was driving one day, and it was really hot. They have something called humidity there, which I'd never experienced before. It's terrible stuff. I hope none of you ever have to experience that.
Yeah, it's rough.
And so I see an old man, and he's wearing a long sleeve flannel, like a Pendleton, and it's buttoned all the way up and it's tucked in, and he's laboring with a gas can. And I just thought, should I pick him up or help him or do something? I didn't, because I'm scared of everybody and everything, apparently. But I just started kind of playing these different scenarios of what would this person be doing? Like, oh, maybe it's for a lawnmower, or maybe it's for who knows what.
A broken down car.
Could be anything. But yeah. I started inventing like all these different scenarios. And then a few months later, I went to there's a fort there. I went to a fort. It's across the river from Fallen Timbers. And I just thought it was so bizarre that people, like the fort was originally burned down and then they built it back up after it had no use. So they could do reenactments. It was just this bizarre thing. And so I put those two things together to create that story.
Are you trying to say anything larger with that, or are you just trying to tell a good story?
Oh, maybe. First and foremost, I want to tell a good story. But if there's some meaning that people can glean out of it, I'm more power to you guys. Please do that.
All right.
I worked hard on it. There's some stuff in there, sure.
Well, I want to ask the writers about the subject of relationships, because Brian's book has probably it would not be very compelling stories if the relationships were like, this marriage is really working out well, and today we had dinner together. The end. I mean, I'm aware that conflict is often important for stories. I think you've got a pretty dark view of relationships based on your book. The stories are certainly interesting. There's everything from what seems to be a woman's kind of midlife crisis to other conflict that I won't go into too much here. Are you writing about relationships for the enjoyment of creating stories? Are you trying to say something there? Can you kind of give me your general thoughts on part three of your book, the third section?
I'm in a great relationship, and I have a wonderful partner. And I think that's the only reason why maybe I feel like I could write about darkness and struggles within relationships, because I think if I was personally struggling that much with my own relationship, I don't know if I'd want to go there with my fiction or not. But yeah, like, yeah, I would, if I read my own work, I think, man, that guy's got, must have a really bad marriage or something. Good Lord. But no, I have a great marriage, which is the weird thing. I'm extremely happy, which is maybe why I like to explore conflict that can arise over being with the same person and, you know, hating the way they drink or eat their soup, and you have to sit across from them for decades knowing that, why do you have to stick your tongue all the way out of your mouth before the spoon goes in? You're driving me crazy. Like, you know, I want to explore that a little bit. Okay. My wife is really good at soup, so yeah. Again, not something I struggle with, but just an example I made up on the fly. But yeah.
Tell me about your thoughts, Kristen, on writing relationships and what makes for an interesting short story.
I mean, I think as far as relationships, it's going to come down to the characters and making the characters complex, because we're all flawed people, and it's important to capture the good and the bad of each character, and to capture the wanting from both sides of the relationships. Like, what does character A want, and what does character B want, and how do they keep getting in the way of them not getting what they want? So I think it's just really about, like, determining, like, capturing the complexity of the characters.
I guess you need conflict, right? I mean, easy peasy is sort of kind of boring.
Right. I mean, you need conflict, and there's plenty of conflict to go around, right? Like, Brian was making the point about the soup. You know, I could go on about the socks and wet laundry and whatnot. But yeah, there are many stories that can come from that sort of, like, domestic conflict.
I want to read a note from a listener named John, who said he thinks the attraction about short stories is they pack so much into so few words, going on what Kristen and Brian were saying. And he says he thinks it was Ernest Hemingway who wrote one of the most emotional short stories in six words, "For sale, baby clothes never used." Is that Hemingway? Peter, do you know?
That is Hemingway. Yeah.
How do I not know that? That's profound. Six words.
You just read your short story for the day.
I did.
Check that box.
I just read a short story. I definitely did. And before we close, I also want to ask our guests about the weird. And I'm trying to get back to, I'm sorry, Brian, but there's a story in your book. Brian Wood is one of our guests, the author of Joytime Killbox, a collection of short stories available from Bow Editions now. And the weird one, it was, oh man, what's your weirdest story in there? I'm flipping through. This is great radio, but trust me, stay with me, listeners, because this is going to get good. What's your weirdest one?
I think they're all kind of weird.
The parrot.
Oh, the parrot. Oh, okay, yeah. It's called Beasts of Flight.
Yes. Yeah. The parrot, the story of the parrot, who is not just repeating words, but, like, is definitely having conversations with people. To my ear, that parrot is, like, responding to questions, isn't just repeating. And then the parrot may have committed a murder. I mean, this quite, parrot goes to prison. Parrot's got to get used to prison food. I mean, the prisoners have got to grapple with the fact that this parrot may be, you know, really dark and murderous. I was not ready for that. Tell me a little bit about how that story came together.
I don't know if it's still a trope, but when I was doing my MFA, there was this trope of, like, talking animal stories, and they're, like, kind of cute and very quirky. And I kept reading a bunch of them, and so I wanted to do my take on a quirky talking animal story. I really don't like those kind of stories, and maybe that's why I wanted to do my version of it. But that's where the genesis of that came out. And then I was fascinated to learn that how smart and amazing African gray parrots are. I think they have a vocabulary of they can learn over 800 words. And apparently they're, like, crazy expensive as well. Cause, my mom looked into buying one, after reading the story, and she's like, oh, this is really expensive. I'm not going to get this bird. But so I was really interested in this bird that actually can talk, and then using that as kind of a way for characters to project their thoughts and feelings on this poor little bird.
Did the bird knowingly cause the person to die in the story?
Of course not. It's an innocent bird. A bird would never kill anybody purposefully.
He did. I knew it. So a little weird's okay, though, right? I mean, it was a totally fascinating story. I thought you were taking us on a journey to kind of show us the notion of sort of animal incarceration. That's how I always overthink stories. Do you see the theme? It's quite a theme, me overthink. Because I got to the end of that one going, huh, Brian's just weird.
I think that's a fair takeaway as well. But no, I mean, I embrace the weird. I watch political debates. Those are really weird.
Those are really weird, for sure.
So why wouldn't I go weird in, in fiction?
That's
so
fair. We have political debates on this show. It can get very weird. Kristen's weird okay with you? Do you ever get kind of weird in your writing?
I don't get too weird. I think I'm veering a little bit towards the weird. But I think the weird is important. I think that the weird shakes up the world as we know it and allows us to see it in a different way. So I think that's what literature should do. And if it's got to be weird to do it, then be weird.
Peter, that parrot is... That parrot is a murderer. I want you to know that.
I keep thinking of Hunter S. Thompson, who was his own genre in and of himself, used to say, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro, which is a great Hunter S. Thompson line, whatever you want to take from it.
How'd you like the parrot story?
I love it. You know, I think what Kristen and Brian are both showing today is that short story writers are great observers of human interaction. And I think because they have to be so concise, each detail really matters. So even when Brian was telling a side story here, you know, he really described the shirt that the person that he had originally been inspired by carrying the gas can was wearing. And, you know, it's just a good example of, like, these are the details that matter. And you think that 98% of our communication with each other is nonverbal. And so short story writers are really good at picking up and describing these nonverbal, not dialogue, cues that let us know what the person is like and what the interaction is like. And so any short story writer who is successful is somebody who is very good at observing and describing human behavior and interaction.
Bethany writes just to say, I'm definitely reading less, Evan, but I just finished Refund by Karen Bender. Phenomenal short stories, inspirational to my own work as a short story writer. I also publish a literary magazine that includes short stories about the Finger Lakes. Here's to the future of short stories. Well, there you go, Bethany. Thank you for that. I appreciate that note. And so on that note, what do you love? I asked our guests to share a short story that you love, that you think we should all grab onto or go find. Brian, I'll start with you.
Sure. The one I'll pick is John Cheever. It was first published in 1954 in The New Yorker. It's called The Country Husband. And it's about a husband who is involved in a near-death plane crash where they have to land in a field. And he goes home to tell his family about it, and nobody cares. They act like nothing happened, and his life goes sideways in his, like, perfect suburban country club life goes completely sideways because of this experience. And it has, for me, easily maybe like the best final paragraph I've ever read in a story. It's so wonderful.
Best final paragraph.
Yeah. And it's weird because I'm not like, I'm from the West Coast, so I don't get these kind of East Coast country club stories. Like, that's not me. I don't.
Whatever. We're not aliens.
But no, but it put me into that world, and I like totally got it, and I understood this person's angst, which somebody that I normally would never identify with.
All right, so what's it called?
It's called The Country Husband.
The Country
by John Cheever.
But from 1954.
1954.
All right, Kristen, what's your choice?
I'm going to go with ZZ Packer's Brownies from her short story collection, Drinking Coffee Elsewhere. And that's a short story in which a young girl is with her brownie troop, and they accuse another girl of voicing a racial slur, and then conflict ensues from there.
So what's it called?
Brownies.
Brownies is your choice. All right. Mm-hmm. Peter Connors, 30 seconds. What it's going to be?
I'm going to go with Raymond Carver, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. You could pick any Raymond Carver story. Just go check out Raymond Carver. They're all really powerful, really concise. And again, a professor, a writer who taught at Syracuse University. So he's got a lot of hometown flavor in there, too.
And I will say, as we close the hour, go read The Lottery and then read Joytime Killbox. Think about the juxtaposition there. Two different eras. Interesting stories. I want to thank our guests. And once again, if you want to get Joytime Killbox by Brian Wood, it's out now. Peter Connors, where can you get it?
Anywhere you buy books.
Anywhere you buy books, especially the small independent booksellers.
Yes, and boaeditions.org.
Boaeditions.org. Brian Wood, congratulations on this, and thanks for sharing with us this hour.
Thank you for looking too far into things.
You're welcome. Wait, what do you mean by that? Kristen Gentry, when your next collection's out, we look forward to talking to you about it, whenever that is. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. And our thanks to the whole team today. Our thanks to Bob volunteering, and our thanks to Emma Ray Stein, the intern. Megan Mack is both producer and the engineer. And there's probably a short story to be told about that. Actually, she's so good, there's no conflict. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.